From the chilly heartland of America on the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with a series of incredible stories, followed by conversations with Linda in the last hour. Here's what's happening. Horrible story out of Mexico City, an explosion ripping through Mexico's best-known fireworks market on the outskirts of the city, killing now at least 29 people, injuring scores more, while sending a huge plume of charcoal gray smoke billowing into the sky. Mexican federal police, the Federales, announced via its official Twitter account that 70 others were injured in what it called the preliminary toll from the afternoon blast. Meanwhile, the manhunt for perpetrators of the attack on Christmas market in Berlin that killed at least 12 continues, as officials in Germany say they cannot rule out that the suspects involved could still be at large. They arrested someone earlier today, let them go. ISIS claiming responsibility. Doug Hagman, private investigator and head of the Northeast Intelligence Network, with us. Doug, I wanted to ask you about ISIS and about this situation in Germany as well. Germany seems to be at war with ISIS, don't they?
Absolutely, George, and that's in direct correlation, I suspect, with the numbers, the immigration numbers. In 2015, last year, the net immigration rose by 50%. We're talking about 1.14 million foreign nationals coming into Germany. And that, of course, this is under Angela Merkel's direction and approval. A hugely unpopular move, but we're also noticing, George, an uptick in significant attack orders, calls for jihad in Europe, specifically in Germany, France, and Italy. And we saw 2 months, actually, less than 2 months before this attack this week, in jihadist communications, calls for truck attacks in Germany, France, Italy, and all across Europe. So not quite unexpected, and the manhunt does continue indeed.
Doug, I'm having a bad feeling about Christmas, just something very strange. Are you picking anything up?
Well, nothing more than the normal. However, I noticed that cities such as Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, and major cities across the United States, are under more severe lockdown this year than they have been in the past for a number of reasons. And again, this is consistent with the uptick in the jihadist communications, the Arabic language forums, and in overt communications magazines and such that support ISIS.
You can track Doug's work at HomelandSecurityUS.com. Doug, have a great Christmas, my friend. Thank you so much. In Brooklyn, more than 250 pounds, that's $2 million worth of magic mushrooms, seized from a grow house in Brooklyn. The investigators executed two search warrants at the house. Detectives found more than 200 pounds of the psychedelic mushrooms, $30,000 in cash, and 300 gift cards. Wonder what they were going to do with that. A former employee of a Florida vending machine company dressed up in a Chewbacca costume stole money from a pair of kiosks that he was maintaining. Well, they arrested him for grand theft. Apparently, he was arrested. He took about $623, but they'll never forget that it was Chewbacca who did it. If you can't remember the last time you took a vacation, you're not alone. More than half of the U.S. workers, half, who are offered paid vacation days, don't use them. According to a new report from Bankrate.com, the workers are leaving 7 vacation days on the average on the table, just continuing to work, work, work. Many of them said, hey, even though I get a paid vacation, I can't afford to go on a vacation. The Dow Jones rising to record highs again. It's just 25 points shy of 20,000. Why? Optimism about U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's policies. We shall see. Going gray due to stress and anxiety is an inseparable part of being human. But new research suggests that we are not alone. Get this. A pioneering study of dogs found that the four-legged animals, our dear friends, may be suffering exactly the same fate. A survey of more than 400 dogs established that going gray around the mouth and the face was not only a sign of distinguished old age, it was stress in the dogs. I wonder what a dog could stress about, huh? I don't know. The Department of Homeland Security and Justice Department have spent collectively more than $95 million on secret cell phone tracking technology and own more than 400 cell site simulators that can be used to zero in covertly on locations of cell phones. The report was just released. Unbelievable. Up next, Lauren Weinstein joins us for the hour as we talk about hacking and the latest world in technology, next on Coast to Coast AM. Lauren Weinstein has been involved with the development of the Internet for decades. We turn to him for all kinds of stories that include hacking, Internet technology, you name it, we go to him. And tonight we're going to talk about hacking, fake news, social networking, and many other things in the latest in the tech world. Lauren, welcome back.
Thank you, as always. I want to take this opportunity to wish you and the Coast team and all the listeners a Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Happy New Year.
You too, Lauren. You too.
And
we'll
just hope the next year is a good one. It's going to be interesting one way or another. We know that for sure.
You know what our gift has been? You. You have been such a delight over the years that we've been talking, providing our great audience with so much incredible information. And I want to thank you for that personally. Oh, okay. And so everybody can really appreciate who you are.
It's been my pleasure, and I want to say that you are the best host on radio, because without you, I wouldn't have this opportunity to say what I say and enjoy this so much.
Many times, Tom has called Lauren at the last minute saying, Lauren, there's a breaking story. And do you ever sleep?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely can't hear the show all the way through every night, but... I do what I can.
Well, you're with us this hour. We're going to take calls in a half hour, and that'll be fun, because we normally just have you for news inserts, but this is going to be fun. Hacking. Yahoo, of course, has been announcing since 2013 that they had a big problem, yeah. And now they're really kicking it up. What the heck happened here, Lauren?
It is. It's almost impossible to fathom. And poor Verizon. They're about the last company in the world that I have any sympathy for. But, at this point, what's Yahoo really worth? $1.50, maybe?
Exactly.
It's hard to say. Apparently, they're now saying that there were a billion accounts hacked. Now,
ouch.
It's hard to even put that into perspective. And this time, you remember they had a lot of hacks earlier, too. This is a separate set of hacks. Some of the information that was obtained is pretty nasty stuff. The passwords were hashed, so they didn't get the direct passwords. But what apparently did get into the hands of the hackers were potentially security questions that were not encrypted.
Aha!
And security questions are—we have come to realize in recent years—a security disaster waiting to happen, because the kinds of questions they ask, typically, what high school did you go to,
what's your mother's maiden name,
all these kinds of things. If you actually answer those questions honestly, which I recommend you never do, if you have to deal with security.
All right, but we may forget then what we said.
Well, then you got to do the other bad thing, which is record it somewhere and really protect that piece of paper,
yeah.
or that file. There's
okay.
You're between a rock and a hard place with these things. But one thing for sure is that if more than one place asks you what was the name of your first school, and you answer honestly, and somebody gets hold of those answers through a hack like this, now you've got a problem. It becomes as bad as when you use the same password at lots of different places, and that password is compromised at one location, and all of a sudden, all those other locations are up for grabs as well. So the Yahoo thing is just, Yahoo is toast. I mean, that's the only way.
They were in trouble once Google started coming, and now they're even in deeper trouble.
It's really sad, too, because I know a lot of really great people at Yahoo. I know great software engineers at Yahoo. I know some who went from Google to Yahoo. And it's very... very, very sad to see a company that's somehow been mismanaged in a way that causes this to happen. I mean, even in this industry where there's this rapid change and things can go bad very suddenly, it's still a remarkable turn of events for Yahoo.
At what point, Lauren, what were they worth, do you think, at their high point?
Oh, gee, I don't even know now.
Would you say billions?
I don't even want to hazard a guess, but in the early days, I remember when I... when I first started the Privacy Forum, or you know, so that was actually decades ago. But you know, along the way, when Yahoo rose to prominence there for a while, and I had the Privacy Forum going in its earlier days, it actually Yahoo ran a directory. It was a manually. They actually had human beings who looked around the net and found things of interest and listed them in these directories by topics. And I remember the Privacy Forum showed up in there one day, and I was really excited. I said, wow, look at that. I got into the Yahoo directory. You know, this was, you know, of course, when Google came along, that kind of changed the whole paradigm of all of this. So, you know, time marches on, but it's still a sad turn of events.
Have they gone the way of MySpace? Same kind of thing?
It's a different kind of failure. losing control over a billion accounts it kind of puts you into a different category, but it's hard to see what assets the amount of value. You know, when a company like Verizon says they're going to buy a company like Yahoo,
and what do they want to buy them for?
Yeah, there has to be something of value, and there's less and less of value there other than the name and obviously users, but I think they're probably shedding users right now at a pretty rapid rate, because who wants to be worried that you're going to be in the next billion accounts that's hacked or something?
Now, how do people hack into companies like this? I mean, you would think they would have firewalls and security systems at large. Is this kind of an inside job, maybe?
I can't speak to Yahoo, of course, because I don't know what happened there. They're saying it was a state actor. But traditionally, the way these kinds of things happen over and over again is what are called the spear phishing attacks, where emails are sent to people on the inside that masquerade as something that, you know, that has links in it that you should click on, and they're actually false emails, and somebody clicks on the link, and that compromises their computer, and then somehow their internal credentials become compromised. And most companies now that are really serious about security have multiple factor security systems. They'll have one-time passwords. They'll have dongles that generate numbers that you have to provide along with your password if you're going to get into a corporate system, or they have security keys that use there's like the FIDO protocol security keys that do a cryptographic handshake. Various ways you want to secure your corporate internal corporate networks, but that doesn't mean that anything's perfect, and as we see in the case of Yahoo, obviously one of these mechanisms, or potentially an inside job, that is certainly a possibility too. We haven't heard anything like that, but that doesn't mean that's not a possibility.
Can't rule it out, that's for sure. Yeah. Fake news, it's been on the minds and the lips of so many people lately. How are they going to control that?
It's a real tough nut to crack, and there's a real risk of knee-jerk reactions by governments. We're starting to see this already. Germany, just within the last few days, has proposed massive fines, I think like 500,000 euros, which, by the way, is now basically the same as a dollar, right?
Right.
A euro, you say, how much is a euro? Well, right now, last time I looked, it was $1.05 a couple of days ago. So here, euros, think dollars. About 500,000 euros per incident of fake news, plus the requirement that there be a way to correct it, to publish a correction, that can be very, very difficult. And my concern is that once you start getting into this mindset of removing information from the internet, of deleting it, and this is why I dislike the EU right to be forgotten so much, because it's a censorship regime. I think that's a real rat hole. I think that's a way you end up with free speech being completely trampled. I do, on the other hand, think that when you have stories that are clearly not true, where there's broad agreement except among maybe a very, very extreme fringe that something is true or false, and that story is trending very highly in social media like Facebook or has reached a very high rank in Google, and Google has a particular problem with a story involving, with a link involving Holocaust denial right now that has been in the news. I think that the right way of dealing with that is to label it somehow. You don't necessarily say it's a lie. Perhaps you say that this is not endorsed, this is not... cannot be verified, it has a very low confidence level, but some way to indicate that there is broad agreement that this is not a fact. It's a tricky area to get into. Facebook has now already said that they're going to be doing something like this. They're going to third parties with certain stories to try to get them verified. But the problem is that you know how do you make these determinations?
And there's so many of them.
Yeah, this is the thing. I mean, like we can probably mostly agree, for example, that the moon isn't made of green cheese, right?
That's right.
Now there are probably some people,
and that the Earth isn't flat, though some people think it is.
So if you have a link about something like that, I don't think there'd be a big problem with putting something on it that said there's very low confidence with this link that somehow got up to the top that says the Earth is flat, and by the way, the moon.
Why don't they put in something where you have the story? It's difficult to control. It's up there, but people can vote on its authenticity. And see where you make a game out of it, where you know you say, you know, okay, is the Pope really an extraterrestrial? Yes, no, or would that not work either?
Well, you actually said the magic word in your statement just now. The you can do that. That's a form of it's crowdsourcing. Really, it's a form of what we call crowdsourcing. The thing is that systems like that have to be designed very carefully to avoid gaming. That's
mm-hmm.
the word. And gaming in this context means purposely manipulating in a false way the data.
Right.
So when you're depending on a lot of people, if you're trying to look at across a broad population how they're voting, it's not necessarily hard these days with the kind of communications capabilities that people have at their fingertips on the net to say, hey, let's all go to this link and vote it down or vote it up for their own purposes, right? So it means that you have to have additional levels of sanity checking and human checking to avoid people purposely manipulating those, because it becomes like SEO, like black hat SEO, where people attempt to manipulate search results to boost their links way up to the top where they can earn more revenue when they're monetized. So and the other thing about this that makes it so tricky is you're dealing with enormous scale. When you look at Facebook or Google or Twitter, the numbers involved in terms of the numbers of users and the number of posts just per day are so staggering that any system you can come up with has to be able to survive being hit millions and potentially billions of times, and that's very, very hard to do.
All right, social networking, growing like crazy. People are popping on Facebook. They're just about everywhere. Is it going to continue to grow? I mean, will there be something else to topple Facebook as Facebook toppled MySpace?
I would think that ultimately, you know, who knows what it's going to look like 5 years from now, much less 20 years from now, right? The names will probably, some of the names may still exist in the same way. Whether they will be functionally the same companies and things is hard to say. For sure right now we can say one thing. The growth of social media around the world outside the U.S. is much larger than the growth in the U.S. The U.S. has become a comparatively mature market in terms of social media and people being online. But if you go to other places in the world, if you go to the Far East and the Middle East and various parts of Asia and all over, there's tremendous growth there as the Internet penetrates, different kinds of systems come online. Interestingly enough, in many parts of the world, cell phones are the major way to access the Internet. Many people don't mm-hmm. have laptops or home Internet connections or anything like that. They're cell phone only, a smartphone only. And that kind of changes their view. And this also becomes controversial when you have companies that attempt to zero-rate their services. This is like when Facebook would say, well, we'll give you free Internet access, but only for accessing Facebook. Or when AT&T
exactly.
says, you access our service, you won't get charged airtime for using it, but if you access other people's services, you will. So that pulls you into all in the U.S., net neutrality issues. EU has their net neutrality issues, and these are going to come up in other parts of the world.
It's almost like extortion, for crying out loud.
Well, it's a very controversial area, and there are signs that it's going to be becoming worse rather than better, because from what we know right now of Donald Trump's picks for the FCC, these are all people who are on the record as being opposed to controls on that kind of action by these corporations, which suggests that if you're a stockholder of AT&T or Comcast or one of those guys, you're probably going to be in really good shape. But if you're just an ordinary internet user, you probably have to watch your wallet.
Well, and that's why the market seems to be trending up. Lauren, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment, talk more about technology, get your thoughts on what's next, and also we'll take phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, when we come back, we're going to take your phone calls with Lauren Weinstein as we talk about technology, incredible technology. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, before we go to calls and before I ask you a few more quick questions, what websites do you prefer people go to check up on your work?
It's always easiest just to go to vortex.com, V-O-R-T-E-X.com, and that has links to pretty much everything else I do along all kinds of different venues.
Were you always a tech guy?
Yeah. I think that's a fair assessment. I definitely wasn't ever a sports guy or anything like that. When I was a kid, I was wiring up buzzers and bells and
I love it.
Minor electrocution, you know, to myself and things like that. But then I just evolved into all these other areas and gradually into policy. I was really a hardcore techie and programmer, coder type. And over time, I kind of drifted into policy issues, and that's where I am very firmly now.
Did you ever wear those pocket pen inserts?
No. I never owned a pocket protector. the funny thing is, I remember in school, all those years, I carried in elementary school and junior high school, I carried a pocket knife, and if you did that now, you'd be expelled.
Wow.
In schools now, right?
That's right.
When we were kids,
you can't do that.
Carry knives in. Yeah, so it's a lot of things have changed over the years.
Yeah, it sure has. A lot of things have changed. And what has done that? Has it been the internet that has changed these things?
I think technology is a driver throughout civilization. I mean, if I'm kind of an armchair student of history, of technology history, and if you can go all the way back, And even, you know, obvious things like the printing press and such, of course, but even before that, technology has a tendency to push history along, not always in directions that people at the time like, because we tend to be, you know, used to the way things are. And whether it's a steam engine or automobiles instead of horses or phones instead of the telegraph or computers instead of phones, it's just sort of a progression. I think the big difference now, which is something that the world has never seen before, is the ability of individuals to reach large numbers of people unfiltered.
Instantly
and without any intermediaries like editors or anything. And as we have now seen, that has all kinds of positive aspects and a whole bunch of negative aspects, too, that we really haven't learned how to deal with yet.
All right, let's go to the calls. Dave is with us from somewhere out there. Go ahead, David. Thanks for joining. Hi, Dave.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey, good evening. How are you?
Good, Dave.
Question. Hacking is big time in the news. Is there any way to provide direct, intangible evidence that would be accepted in a court of law that X hacked into Y?
Yeah. Yeah. You can do it. If you have a suitable chain of evidence, just like in any other court case where you need to have evidence that can be verified and demonstrated to be correct to some reasonable level of acceptability. One of the problems is, of course, that when you're talking about very technical situations, it requires a certain amount of knowledge of technology to understand it. And so if you're looking at jury trials and things, usually there just isn't time to bring juries up to the level of background knowledge that would be required to really understand it properly. So in that case, prosecutors, for example, will tend to move more into, you know, emotional arguments and things because they just can't. You can't give someone a 20-year training in computer science in an hour and a half. But you can do it, and it's tricky because the first level that you look at when you look at hacking and you're trying to trace a hack, like right now there's a pretty strong consensus among the CIA and the FBI that the Russians were behind these political attacks in this last election. And it's also clear that they apparently attacked both Democrats and Republicans, so there's all kinds of juicy things they have on everybody that they can, you know, use for blackmail and for political purposes later going forward. And it took a lot of work for them to determine that it really was Russia, because it's possible to use indirection and false flags and all these kinds of things too. But from what we're seeing now, it looks like the evidence is very strong, and the FBI and the CIA and other intelligence agencies are using valid techniques, valid technological techniques to pin this down. But it does take a lot of resources to do that. So if you try to do this on your own, trying to find out who's hacking something, you're liable to be misled. It really takes a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of resources to do it right.
And talk about synchronicity. Dave, you are in the Facebook building, I understand.
We're doing some earthquake retrofit work out here.
Aha! That's very smart. They're concerned about earthquakes up that way, Lauren.
And down here, too.
Yeah, we sure are. Let's go to Jack in Oceanside, California now, west of the Rockies. Hi, Jack. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Well, to follow up on the last caller, I have to say I would rarely hear about anybody getting caught and going to jail. But I wanted to follow up on this Russian hacking. I think this might be more interesting.
Okay, go ahead.
Do you remember, well, you may not remember, depending on how old you are, when the Cuban Missile Crisis, JFK went before the nation on TV.
He sure did.
And he presented the evidence. He showed us the U-2 photos of the missiles in Cuba. Okay? I would say that this would be an equal incident where the United States, it's incumbent upon the United States government to show us the evidence that the Russians hacked and had an influence on this election. So my question to you is, what would that evidence be? What would the president comes before the nation, he shows us the evidence, what would be the evidence that would convince the average person in this audience that, oh, well, yeah, that's the Russians, that's conclusive. And do you buy the argument if they did that, it would reveal sources and methods? Because that's like a cop-out to me.
Okay, I do. You know, I know exactly what you're referring to about the Cuban missile crisis. The thing is that photos are something that you can look at and understand. I mean, you can point at it and say, this is a missile launching installation.
Of course, now they could be photoshopped.
Now, right. But in 1959, well, you could still do it in 1959. You could do, you know, there was still
you could
ways
have faked
to manipulate
it.
Photos, but
right.
It took a lot more expertise to do it, of course. This is a missile silo. Here is a missile that's ready to be put onto a launcher. It was something that was accessible to people. When it comes to the internet and to the kinds of computer security questions we're talking about now, even if you're an expert at it, you have to study and you have to have enough background to be able to even just to comprehend the terminology right. The sources and methods argument is valid. I think it may be overplayed in some circumstances. I think that there would be ways to release a significant amount of data without jeopardizing sources and methods to any significant degree. But it's also not clear that even doing that would help convince people, because what are you going to show them? You can't, you know, if you just show IP addresses and domain records and routing tables and all of that, people like me are going to look at it and say, oh, well, that's convincing. But why would anybody expect people that haven't spent all these years, you know, studying this kind of thing and working in this day and night to have a way to grasp it? So it's a very, very tough situation. I don't have any magic wand solutions for it.
Well, and, you know, the election people, you know, boasted about how they couldn't get hacked, that we had nothing to worry about. So what are we talking about? Did the Russians break in and change the votes?
The problem with election hacking is that if you do election hacking right, you don't leave any evidence behind. And when you look at it afterwards, you can't show that there was any hacking. That's the purpose of a great election hack.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like a hack of a bank. If you hack a bank, money vanishes from one account and goes into another account, and even if it takes time to unwind it all and figure out what went where, there's records of it. But elections, by definition, at least in the U.S., are supposed to be secure, and anonymous. So because of that, anonymous factor, you don't have the kinds of records you could use to go back later and figure out if there was hacking, if it was a really quality job. So a crude hack, a simpleton hack, you might be able to tell occurred. But a hack that was a real quality hack, you might have no way to know it ever happened in the first place. Nice. It's a very scary thing, and that's why this whole hacking situation has drawn the attention of so many people, not just in politics, but in technology like where I work, because we're desperately trying to figure out a way to deal with this.
Why don't we go back to the old punch card system? It's slower, but so what?
Well, I prefer mark and sense. You know, the punch cards, we had the hanging chads, right?
So, yeah.
But I prefer the optical scan. That's what we use here in L.A. County, where we put the little circles in the holes, just like in the ovals, just like on school tests. It's a tried-and-true technology. It goes into optical scanners. You have the physical cards you can use later to recount. But the reason there was this big push into electronic voting, and even worse now, you've got people who want to do Internet voting, which if you want to let people hack the election, you want to have election hacks, go ahead, do Internet voting. It's because it's money. There's money to be made selling electronic voting systems and Internet voting systems. There isn't that much money to be made selling optical voting technology that's 20, 30 years old. But that's still the best technology to use. I agree with you.
Next up, we go to Brittany in Florida. Hi, Brittany. Good morning.
Good night for me. How are you?
All right, good.
Well, actually, first-time caller, first-time listener. I've driven through four states today, and I like my talk radio, and, of course, I've run across a lot throughout the states. And I've been listening to you guys since the beginning of the show, and I actually just wanted to say two things, really. What a good job your guest, I don't even remember his name.
Mr. Weinstein, Lauren Weinstein.
Just call me Lauren, that's fine.
What a good job you do of getting your point across and making your information accessible. I'm an educated person. I use technology for my job. But at the same time, I'm not a techie. And you speak to an audience like a very good professor. You can really come down to our level and make it understandable. And just as a listener, I appreciate that. And I actually plan to follow some of your publications and some of the things you do and just continue listening because I've really learned and enjoyed listening to you.
Well, very good. Talking. Thank you, Brittany.
And,
thank you.
You know, and I may be wrong about this because, again, I've never heard either of you speak before tonight, but I also wanted to say I feel like you've done a really good job of just giving information. You know, I'm like everybody else. I have my opinions, but I like my news as skewed to either side as little as possible, and you guys seem to do a really good job of that. And, again, I may listen for 3 or 4 days and find out, you know, that I was wrong. But
oh, no, you won't be wrong, Britt. You won't be wrong.
That's what I've gotten, and you don't find that nowadays. I'm certainly not going to get into that whole, you know, debacle. But I think what you guys have done tonight has been extremely informative and just factual. And you don't find that very often. Maybe that's why I need to listen to the radio at 1 a.m. a lot more. But you guys have done a really great job of that, and I just appreciate all you're doing.
Okay, thank you. And you drive carefully out there. That was very kind of her.
Bert. Very nice.
Very nice indeed. Let's go to Newark, Delaware. Jim is with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Jim. You're on with us. Go ahead.
Hey, George. I think George had a guest on that gave me the impression that Google is actually an arm of the government or a tool that the government uses. Is that true?
No.
No?
It's not true, and I've, as I say in my official disclaimer, I'm not currently consulting to Google, but I have consulted.
But you
Google.
Have.
I know Google really well, outside and inside. They're not an arm of the government. You won't find a group of people anywhere who wants to do the right thing for their users and for the public. The proof of that is the way Google reacts when the government has come to them with overreaching requests for information and such, which has happened in the past, and Google rejects them. I mean, they will go to court and they will fight the government on these things. Just very recently, they released information on some of the national security letters that the government had served on them. So they try to be completely transparent on this, and frankly, I think a lot of times the government just thinks of Google as being a thorn in their side because Google just won't roll over for them.
I love technology, Lauren. Where does it go next? What's next?
Well, this, assuming we don't have a, you know, a collapse of civilization and everything.
Well, right? Let's hope not.
Yeah, that's always the proviso that's there.
Always possible.
It's clearly mobile is the big growth area now. So much work is going into boosting internet speeds for mobile. Like we were saying earlier in the hour, for a lot of people, mobile is their only way of accessing the internet from a smartphone, for example. And I think we're going to continue to see massive growth in that area. A lot will depend on how governments react. I mean, we do see governments cracking down around the world in all kinds of different ways on the internet because they just don't like the free flow of information.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly happening in places like China and Russia. The EU is moving in those directions, and there's people, you know, there's people that want to do that here in the U.S. as well. And oddly enough, you'll find that it's the big dominant ISPs like AT&T and Comcast and some of the others that actually want to control speech. You don't normally think of ISPs as being opposed to free speech, but if you look at their arguments in courts and things, they really want to control the internet. And it's all about money. So that's kind of the battle that's in play. You have sort of free speech on one side, money on the other, but it's all rolled up into kind of a complicated mess. It's hard to tell who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. The one thing we know for sure is, one way or another, the kinds of technological breakthroughs that we're seeing now are going to continue. We're going to see faster internet speeds, more internet access. The big question is going to be, what's going to be flowing over that internet? Will we have free speech? Will we have censorship? What will the data look like? What will our actual communications look like? The technology will be there, but will we have the wisdom to use it properly?
That's a good point. Let's go to Fausto, get him in real quickly in Toronto on the international line. Fausto, go ahead.
All right, a few questions. Hi, George. Joy. Hi, Mr. Hi. Stein?
Weinstein.
Weinstein,
hi.
Just call me Lauren, please.
All right. I really was going to, really not, I just woke up, sorry.
Really only time for one question, Fausto. Go ahead.
Oh.
I'm right at the end.
How do I encrypt my SD card so the bad guys who pose as good guys will not get credit for my work ever again and misuse information? I need to encrypt my stuff so bad people don't get their hands on my information. And now I'm the
world. All right. How does he encrypt his own stuff?
How does he encrypt his own stuff?
30 seconds.
In 30 seconds. There's so many different encryption systems and encryption programs and such. I'm very reluctant to try to do a 20-second, 30-second answer here. PGP is always worthwhile to look at. There are many others also. I recommend using open source systems whenever possible rather than proprietary systems because it's easier to verify that the open source systems are correctly programmed and don't have back doors in them and things like that. Stay away from the fly-by-night commercial packages that claim all kinds of wonderful abilities, because if it sounds too good to be true, we know that it probably is.
There he is. Lauren Weinstein, the expert on the internet, has provided us with great information tonight. Up next, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. Because of Christmas, we're moving her up a few days. So this is her month. She's next.